Mr. Goldsmith, if you please.
Welcome to The Goldsmith Odyssey, our chronological journey through the works of Jerry Goldsmith. I'm Yavar.
I'm Clark.
And I'm Jens. From the late 50s through the early 60s, Jerry Goldsmith wrote a considerable amount of music for television shows, some of which fell into obscurity.
Which almost nobody has seen today.
If you really want to find them, there's people who will sell them to you on the internet.
Peck's Bad Girl you can even acquire commercially.
That's true. There's a, what is this thing called? TV Classics.
I remember this classic that lasted 14 episodes back in 1959. Peck's Bad Seed.
Peck's Bad Girl, a CBS sitcom.
Easy to see why this one didn't have like a 7-season run or whatever.
I mean, I kind of admire some things about it. In terms of its technical qualities, it's pretty impressive what they did with live TV here for this dinky little, you know, nothing sitcom. If you compare it content-wise to The Honeymooners, which I'm a fan of, it suffers. But if you compare it technically, it's leaps and bounds ahead.
Yes.
This show is, on a technical level and on a narrative level to some degree, pretty ambitious and a little bit ahead of its time, I think you could argue. It's also bad, but... You know, the sitcom families of the 1950s tended to be a lot more sort of harmonious than this one is. There's a lot of chaos and bickering here that feels a little bit atypical for the time, like it's almost gently ribbing the idea of a Leave It to Beaver sitcom family.
I don't know, maybe I don't have the right frame of reference, but it didn't strike me as being particularly different from Father Knows Best.
In terms of the way it portrays the father, I think it is very similar to a lot of shows of the era, emphasizing the idea that he is the wise, all-knowing figure that ultimately is right at the end of the day about most things.
I don't know about that. He seems pretty out of his element at times, kind of befuddled at the behavior of his wife and daughter.
Of course he's befuddled. He's a scientist.
Right. But definitely the definitive authority figure in the house. You get that idea from the show.
It's a family that quibbles, but at the end of the day, they're going to stick together.
The intensity of the quibbling here, while not high, is higher than average, I think, for a 50s TV series.
Did you guys also have the feeling maybe this show, Peck's Bad Girl, actually needed a laugh track? This was in the days of live TV, so they had a live audience to laugh at the jokes. But in her opening monologue, when she's going through the members of her family, and she gets to her brother, and she's like, then there's my brother, he's a monster, and she pauses for a moment, it's laugh here.
There are a few awkward moments caused by the live TV side of this. One of my favorites was a kind of hilariously overlong close-up of the kid who plays the little brother gearing up to deliver his line for like 5 seconds until he finally blurts it out. Stuff like that is pretty funny.
Why does Tori Peck walk the longest route around the table to sit at the chair that she could have just walked directly to and sat down? Have you noticed that?
Like all of these moments, Yavar,
yeah.
Think about it like this. That moment in the opening introductory fourth wall breaking sequence where it leaves the pause. That gives us the opportunity to hear the little menacing figure that Goldsmith wrote for her little brother. Just like her taking the long way around the table allows Goldsmith to keep the wacky comedy rhythm going for like another 3 or 4 beats.
This was a long 25 minutes. I respect, you know, from a distance, a lot of what it's trying to do, especially on a technical level. But man, it's kind of a chore.
In my mind, its failures are entirely thematic.
Yeah.
I don't think it pays off very much of what it sets up particularly well.
It's empty. It's fluff.
Well, we should talk about some of the people behind this show that caused this show to exist.
Mm-hmm. Let's do that.
Peck's Bad Girl was produced by Stanley Rubin. who also produced Babe in 1975, with Jerry doing the music, of course. Mm. And it was also executive produced by Norman Felton.
Yeah, he worked with him multiple times during this period here.
Unlike Felton's classic, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or Dr. Kildare, however, Peck's Bad Girl doesn't really have much of a pop culture footprint.
No.
I have to confess, you know, and I'd like to think I'm fairly familiar with classic TV. I had never heard of Peck's Bad Girl before hearing about its Goldsmith connection.
Trying to research this show, you're going to find much more information about the work from which it takes its title. A Peck's Bad Boy by turn-of-the-century newspaper publisher, author, and governor of Wisconsin, George Wilbur Peck.
Now, before you tell me anything else about it, in my head, I'm imagining this is like a Little Women, Little Men situation, and Peck's bad boy is the father in this show, and it's about when he was a kid.
I actually think the connection is tangential at best. Apparently, it was a gigantic hit at the time, and the phrase Peck's bad boy entered the common English vernacular.
It makes sense that this is a sort of a play on words here, trying to riff on a phrase I suppose more people would have known at the time, because on its own, Peck's bad girl is a weird name for this show.
Yes. It is.
Henry Peck.
Peck, 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 Peck.
He's
Peck.
Really a... He think of him as the Bart Simpson of his day.
Oh, I wonder if the pilot episode has her playing pranks or something more actively, since this turned out not to be the pilot, but the third.
This is from ctva.biz, the classic TV archive.
Oh, yeah.
Tori has a crush on her male teacher and brings him home to meet her parents. Rather than hurting Tori's feelings, the adults play along.
Mm.
I'd be much more interested to see that episode than Adventures with Lipstick.
I guess a 12-year-old girl doesn't have to work nearly as hard to transgress social norms as a young boy did 60 years earlier. Clark, why don't you furnish us with your patented plot synopsis?
Well, this episode, Lips That Touch Lipstick, centers on Tori Peck, who is played by Patty McCormick, a free-spirited 12-year-old girl who's just entering adolescence. Tori's father, Steve, played by Wendell Corey, worries that Tori is too much of a tomboy, but he worries even more when she starts showing an interest in things like boys and lipstick. So while Steve's wife, Jennifer, played by Marsha Hunt, attempts to calm Steve's fears, Tori focuses on getting ready for her very first big date.
Riveting.
Yep, all it takes for Tori to plunge her father, Steve, into a minor crisis of conscience is to insist on wearing makeup to a party.
Really, to just exist. She's a tomboy early on, and he panics about this.
And he made her a tomboy.
Right,
we
right,
know
right.
That...
So she's out, like, playing baseball or whatever with the kids, and her father's like, oh, is she too much of a tomboy? Isn't she supposed to be acting feminine? This is weird. This is terrible. And then she starts doing what he allegedly wants her to be doing, acting like, quote-unquote, more of a girl, I guess, wanting to go on dates with boys and put on lipstick and things.
And then he freaks out about that.
Yes, and then, of course, he's panicking about that just as much, if not more. I think just her being 12 years old and a girl is generally his problem.
This episode does start in an interesting way with Tori breaking the fourth wall and addressing the audience. I kind of have the impression that she does this every episode, maybe with slight variations.
Tori's setup and wrap-ups of each episode are something the show did consistently throughout its first and only season. Yavar, I could sense you wanting to ask how I know this.
Yeah.
It is on ctva.biz.
Oh, yeah.
I'm 12 years old, and believe me, that's pretty rough. Sometimes I even think it's impossible. Of course, I'm also a girl, which makes it even harder. Being a boy is a snap, but I'm glad I'm not a boy. The only nice thing about being a boy is that you don't have to marry one. But being a girl, boys are the only things there is to marry. So as you can see, it's murder all the way around. Then there's another problem. I've got a family. My mother used to play on the girls' hockey team in college.
Breakfast!
She's a very good cook. And my father's the handsomest man in the world.
Coming!
He's also a research physicist.
Mom!
Then there's my little brother. He's a monster. But I wouldn't trade any one of them for $1 trillion. The only trouble is, they don't understand me. I don't know why. There's nothing hard about me to understand. I like baseball, strawberry ice cream, covered with chocolate and maraschino cherry, pet boom, blue convertibles, and I hate mathematics and brushing my hair, and dog catchers, and artichokes. And most of all, I hate Sheila Dorchester, who's so stuck up because her mother went to school with Alan Ladd. Now, what's so hard to understand about me? But you have to see it, too. Well, take like today. It's a plain Saturday morning. Breakfast time.
CBS Television Network presents Peck's Bad Girl. Starring Wendell Corey, Marsha Hunt, and Patty McCormick as Tori Peck.
Goldsmith uses this introductory sequence as an opportunity to set up some character themes.
Mm-hmm.
A lullaby-like melody for Tori that seems much too innocent, crossing over into schmaltz. I read this as a little deceptive, maybe, that this is the way that Tori wants others to think of her, that she's giving her own self-serving perspective on things. But I don't know if that's just me being crazy.
That's you being hopeful, because it's not really borne out.
That would be the smarter version of what's happening here, because if it's not that, I think the theme is cloying, maybe, in a way that a lot of Goldsmith stuff is not. And to me, not one of his better melodic ideas that we've covered so far.
I enjoy it. It has no depth to it, but I like its skippy nature. It's sprightly and...
Wait, are we talking about the twinkly opening part or like the main title part?
Isn't it the same theme, just given different treatments? It's kind of introduced in the shorter motif version before it's developed in an extended treatment for the main title.
Yeah, but at least I wouldn't describe it as sprightly early on. Later, when it's like the main title, that's a different kind of thing, and I do think that's better. Which has almost a Georges Delerue kind of feel to me. Very
right.
Breezy and carefree and kind of charming.
I think that's a theme for the family, because he will play that theme with different instrumentation and treatment for different characters. Like when she introduces her mother and then her father, we get slightly different versions of the theme. It feels a little French because there's some instrumentation, there's an accordion used in the melody, which we later find out in the score, there's a reason that it's in the ensemble this week.
Yep, so better make use of it, you know, where you can, because you really kind of just need it for that one cue.
Things were so economical at the time that I think there was this cue relating to France that they needed an accordion, but he also wanted to use it elsewhere in the score.
There you go.
I like Goldsmith in this very cheerful, carefree comedy mode.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a sound that we usually get from him, and he doesn't... I mean,
it happens occasionally. He has some lighter 60s scores, maybe some parts of Trouble with Angels.
Yeah, you hear it a little bit in certain scores. I think it's probably closest to that little accent button cue from A Marriage of Strangers that we discussed before.
It's also, if we want to go for a deep cut here, pretty reminiscent of that 10-second Perry Mason cue of Perry Mason jauntily entering his office. And that cute kind of sitcom-y sound is sort of present here.
It sounds familiar to me, like there's some score with a prominent cue that it reminds me of, but I just can't think of exactly what it is.
We don't have to compare everything to later Goldsmith.
But maybe when we'll get to that later Goldsmith, we'll say, ah, this sounds like Peck's Bad Girl.
Exactly.
It'd be great if we still use Peck's Bad Girl as a touchstone for Goldsmith's music by the time we're in like the late 60s.
I mean, honestly, both this score and Sergeant and the Lady, they're so slight and very brief scores, but they do seem like the first appearances of their respective styles, at least on film, in Jerry's output.
It doesn't sound like a whole lot of things later on that I can think of, honestly. Pretty unique in his career, the score.
The comedy scoring for this is pretty on the nose. It is literally on the nose when Roger is thoughtlessly playing with the kitchen door and accidentally slams it into his father's face. The music there accentuates the reveal of what has happened.
That scene, to me, I don't know if either of you felt this way, but it comes off a little bit more threatening than I think it intends to. The door getting slammed in his face and, you know, hitting him on the nose. And then the entire family cowering back to the table as he slowly enters, like, what is he gonna do?
Yeah, Daddy is not happy. And there's this striking little percussive motif. I don't know what the instrument is. It's a weird Jerry sound.
I like it. It's just an aspect of Mickey Mousing a little bit.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is probably one of his most blatantly Mickey Mousey scores that I've heard. And I suppose that's fair enough given the material. It's pretty superficial sitcom stuff and he treats it as such, basically.
And there are sometimes very brief comedic moments musically that last only 5 or 6 seconds, like the next cue.
When Steve laments that he got up early for breakfast to get to know the children better, it prompts his wife, Jennifer, to explain that this is just the way that they are. And this, of course, demands a comedic stinger.
Yeah, he's very much working in the musical style of the time on this episode, and there are lots of these teeny tiny little cues that basically just exist to provide a transition and say, ha ha, wasn't that funny?
And then there's the other kind of little button cue, which is the act-in music that uses the main theme.
Yep, coming back from commercial.
This is something that these two scores have in common with very different themes, but Sergeant and the Lady also will just have this brief, super fragmentary version. And that's all Goldsmith needs to set the scene and give something a bit of identity. Let's talk about the next substantial cue we have.
Tori wants to go to the school party with a boy named Alfred, who insists that he will only go with a girl who is wearing lipstick.
Yeah, I gotta say, this kid is kind of a turd.
He's bad.
I mean, yeah, he's the bad boy of this episode.
Well, but not too much of a turd that he can't still bond with Tori's
father.
Well,
you know,
two peas in a pod.
It takes one to know one, yeah. If I were Tori's father and this kid came in with this whole little, you know, I'm not going to go with any girl who doesn't wear lipstick routine, that would be the last time he would come over, I think.
So Jennifer tries to placate Steve about this by explaining that she too went out with boys when she was 12.
In France.
Since it is about France, we've got the accordion, and the melody takes on a stereotypically French air.
This piece is interesting in that it's a little less kind of overtly comedic and broad, I guess, than some of the other stuff in the score. It sounds a little bit more mature, I suppose, than most of the music in this episode. Still pretty simple and surface level, but, you know, something a little bit different. Kind of a quiet cue, hard to really hear all the details under this dialogue, but yeah.
There is a new little motif as Tori kind of flashes an innocent smile and leaves her parents about a minute into it, so keep your ears open for that. But I also really like the development of the Peck family theme in this, because as you said, it feels like has a little more depth to it. It's a little more sympathetic as the parents reminisce about Tori growing up.
There you are.
You were going with boys when you were 12?
Not boys, boy. It was while father and I were living in Paris. His name was Philippe. He took me to the top of the Eiffel Tower. Philippe de Vivier.
And we also have to take into consideration I'm very mature for my age.
Why, I never knew you went out with a boy when you had a boyfriend when you were 12.
Well, the subject never came up. Besides, it didn't seem very important.
Then it's all settled?
Huh?
I can wear lipstick at the party?
You see all the other girls gonna wear lipstick?
Well, there might be a few squares. You know how some girls are.
I'll tell you what. More than half of them wear lipstick, you can wear lipstick too.
It's a deal! Mother, I'm so glad you were a girl too. If you weren't, I don't think I could bear it.
It seems that we just got out of
the thumb-sucking stage when we went right into sibling rivalry period. I did think when we got past sibling rivalry that, well, we could have a few years to just take it easy. But here we are, right into adolescence. It just isn't fair.
When I was 12 years old, I didn't even know girls were alive. I was too busy inventing a rocket to the moon. While you were out gallivanting around with boys. French boys!
Steve, of course, was very misguided setting those terms that you can wear lipstick if more than half of the girls at the party do.
Right,
because
right.
of the unintended consequence, which is that Tori goes on a campaign to convince as many other girls as possible to wear lipstick, while Steve tries to talk some of them out of wearing lipstick. Which leads to the next important scene, where Tori is attempting to persuade her best friend Louise, a shy and awkward girl, that she could gain some confidence by wearing lipstick. And this whole spiel eventually turns into a general lesson on how to get boys to notice you, culminating in Tori teaching Louise an alluring walk.
I don't like this scene. Such a clunky cornball bit, and the score really accentuates that, I think.
And Goldsmith does what the scene demands.
He does what he was asked to do, but it just underscores literally what a dumb scene this is, honestly.
Yeah, it is. But he gets some flexible treatment for the main theme in it, so that's at least a little entertaining musically.
I mean, you get to hear this kind of, you know, sultrier version here, and then you get this clunky, awkward-sounding music for the other girl's failed attempt at a sultry walk.
And another comedic transition tag at the end.
Yep. Bringing it all home.
Hi.
You need practice. Lots of practice.
Corey!
This is maybe the point where I have to admit that I actually enjoy Peck's Bad Girl.
While recognizing that it's bad?
Yes, it crosses over into So Bad It's Good territory for me.
Just right here at this moment?
This is... This scene, definitely. And this piece of music, it's so big and obvious, but kind of genuine. And then I enjoy that stupid, oafish stomp. I'm glad we're not assigning ratings, because I'd have to rate it higher than Marriage of Strangers.
Well, for one thing, it's like a third the length, so that helps.
That would be my main positive thing. It's only 25 minutes, so that's worth something.
Meanwhile, after the sequence where Steve and Alfred talk about whether or not girls should be wearing lipstick, there's a scene where Alfred calls for Tori and she doesn't immediately come to him. Alfred exasperatedly exclaims, "Women!" And Steve and Alfred have this little moment where they just kind of agree on how women don't come when they're called.
Very 1950s television for you there. Uh-huh. This one does stand out among these throwaway transition cues, though, because it feels a little bit more aggressive and irritated than the others, mm-hmm. to underscore that women sentiment.
It's a product of its time.
Very much so.
I mean, you can say that about other much better shows, though.
After our pilot episode zero, we had an email from a listener who wanted us to come at the material more as a listener of the time would. He urged us to forsake our modern perspectives and put ourselves into the shoes of an audience member then. And I've kept that piece of feedback in the back of my mind ever since. And mostly I think I've succeeded. But in the case of these two shows that we're reviewing today,
it's pretty hard to do.
I'm finding it a little hard.
Audiences then didn't respond to it too strongly either. It would have lasted more than 14 episodes.
Once Tori wins the bargain with her father, convincing over half of the girls to wear makeup, she starts realizing the negative impacts of her machinations. turns out that Louise got in trouble. That's Tori's friend, for practicing the sexy walk at home. Now won't get to see Tori for a while. As Steve sends her off to get changed for the party, the music takes on not a celebratory, but a thoughtful, slightly unsure tone. Corey guiltily avoids direct eye contact with her father as she slinks off, and we can already sense from the music that a change of heart is coming.
It is a nicer, more poignant, heartfelt version of the theme, though it's brief.
Yeah, and then there's just that slightly more chipper little melody that arrives at the very end of this cue.
I think it's a different cue. It almost feels like the previous poignant cue gets cut off abruptly. Like, I kind of had the sense listening to it, maybe Jerry wrote a little bit more, and for some reason with that scene transition, it ends more abruptly than it had been planned to.
Yeah.
That sprightly little bit at the end of the cue, that's Steve coming home from dropping Roger off at a friend's house. At this point, Steve and Jennifer have a lengthy scene where they discuss how quickly their kids are growing up, getting older in general, and the uselessness of parenting guidebooks. But apparently, Steve and Jennifer don't really need parenting guidance, because that little seed of guilt earlier has caused Tori to change course completely. The music here is subtle, you know, growing ever sweeter, suggesting a coming together of Tori and Steve.
It's a further development of the mood of the previous cue.
Those two definitely are dramatically and thematically connected. It's really the setup and the resolution, those two cues.
Sure, just sadly very brief.
Yeah, it's warm and gentle, and, you know, the scene itself, kind of eye-roll-inducing, I guess, where he's essentially assuring her that he was wrong about things, and she's assuring him that she was wrong about things, and they were both wrong, but they're both on the same page now, and they love each other, and she values her family more than boys, and yada, yada, yada.
Daddy, I'm sorry.
You sorry for what?
Well, sometimes a girl gets too busy. You know, with her schoolwork and her friends and Girl Scouts, stuff like that. She sort of gets out of touch with her parents.
I see.
But I'm going to try to find more time to spend with you and Mommy. Because I want to be the kind of girl you want me to be.
You are, baby. You are.
This would have been so much more interesting if she was actually bad rather than just doing whatever Daddy wants at the end and being Daddy's little girl.
You promised me a Pex bad girl, and you gave me just Pex girl. Disappointing.
Can we talk? It's not on the list, but I just wanted to comment briefly about that final brief tag cue.
That's exactly the same cue as in the beginning of the episode.
I guess the thing that stood out to me in both of those cues is the comedic xylophone usage.
This second occurrence is like a second longer.
All right.
We can play it again. Before Tori's wrap-up monologue, there's a brief final scene at the children's party where Steve feels underdressed because all of the other fathers there are wearing suits and he isn't. And Alfred shows Tori that he still cares about her by punching her upper arm.
In the classic tradition of young men throughout the history of fiction.
Expressing their affection, indeed.
And she's very excited about this, we must say. She comes bursting forth, declaring how happy she is that he punched her.
Yep.
Yep. And we won't read anything else into that.
Oh, wow.
Nope. This then leads straight into the wrap-up, reprising thematic material from the introduction.
Yeah, it's a nice kind of bookend to the score, because it mirrors the opening cue when she's doing her address to the audience again.
Yeah, it's nice to hear the, you know, the proper main title theme appear again, since that, to me, is the best idea in this score.
See how it goes? I don't think those books about raising children help. They just tell you what to worry about, and then tell you you shouldn't worry about it. For instance, there's no sense in my father worrying about Alfred. I'm not going to marry Alfred. I'm just using him. And raising children is simple. All you have to do is keep them off the streets,
See that their teeth are brushed. Feed them fresh vegetables. And don't read any of those books. That's all.
Girl is a CBS Television Network production.
I think people have gotten a pretty good idea of our opinions about this episode already.
I don't think we need to get into a lengthy review. I think we can jump straight into score opinions. This is one of those cases where Jerry Goldsmith is doing exactly what the material demands. But what the material demands is fairly obvious comedy music. As predictable and slight as it is, the music is of a technically high caliber and very pretty, but it's not exactly essential Goldsmith. So I will give this a 5.5 out of 10.
Well, I agree with you, Jens, although I think you are a little too kind in your rating. I mean, it certainly does the job that it set out to do, but if I'm comparing this with other Goldsmith scores, 5.5 is what Clark and I gave for that Perry Mason episode, Paul Drake's Dilemma, and that was another functional score, but even that felt like it had a little more depth and interesting things it was doing, even though it was competing with source music a lot of the time.
I thought you really underrated that one.
Well, you thought we underrated it by 0.5.
Well, 0.5 means a lot on the scale.
When we agree as much as the three of us do, that's pretty dramatic, that 0.5.
So, I don't know. This one is so slight, I have to say, on the Goldsmith scale that I'm going to give it a 4.5. I'm going to go a whole point less than you. It's not bad. It's just so fluffy and inconsequential. It's not something that I'd feel super drawn to listening to again. But I do appreciate that it is a fairly unique entry in Goldsmith's output, and I do think it established this lighter comedic tone for a few of his future scores.
Ivar, if it makes you feel better, I'm in a very similar place with this score. And yes, I do think it's important to remind people we are grading on a Goldsmith curve here, you know, relative to the quality of the rest of the stuff he's written over the course of his career. Of course, this being a Jerry Goldsmith score, it fulfills the episode's requirements admirably. But the approach here is so shallow and surface level, and the themes, for the most part, the music here, not really striking or memorable to me. I do like the arrangement of the actual main title, that kind of Delarue-sounding thing. I like that. Otherwise, there's very little here that I would really have a strong desire to listen to again. I think it's functional without ever really going above and beyond at any point in the way that Goldsmith has done in so many of his other scores. So I would rate this one a 4 out of 10.
Wow. 4.
So 4 plus 4.5 plus 5.5 is 14. We can round up to 4.7.
Our lowest score for a Goldsmith effort to date.
Indeed.
At least people can no longer say, as in HMS Pinafore,
very nice.
I think it's possible there are Goldsmith fans out there who this will appeal more to, this side of his output. But for myself, I'm actually much more attracted to the next score we're going to discuss, even though it is also fairly surface level. It's a lot more enjoyable to me.
So let's talk a little bit about The Sergeant and the Lady. Of course, Peck's Bad Girl, a show that lasted 14 episodes. This is a show that lasted only one episode. And we are going to dig into that episode today.
I think this pilot may not have even aired.
It was an unaired pilot.
So it lasted zero episodes, technically, but this one does exist, so an episode was made.
The Sergeant and the Lady was the brainchild of Herb Meadow, who is credited as both writer and creator of the show. Meadow was a pretty prolific writer, even at the time, but is perhaps most notable for co-creating Have Gun Will Travel with Sam Rolfe,
which we'll be getting to in a little bit on The Odyssey.
Pretty good show.
Looking forward to that. It's got some awesome stuff.
I can only imagine that the runaway success of Have Gun Will Travel, which debuted just a year earlier, is what got CBS on board with this concept. A buddy cop show where one of the policemen is... Wait for it! A policewoman!
You make fun, but I wonder if in 1958 this was the first of these kind of shows, even though this is dated and clunky in some ways.
And admittedly, I'm not the world's greatest historian on classic cop dramas, but I don't recall a lot of older shows, certainly, where female cops had a prominent role on a series in the 1950s or 60s. It's different.
If we were looking at it as audiences of the day, as we were told to, we would actually think this was a reasonably progressive show because it actually had, you know, half of the main characters female and a competent policewoman, you know, at the same time. She even gets in on the action near the end.
Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to imagine somebody in the 1950s, like, say, Mr. Peck, watching this and going, hold on. The lady is a cop, too?
One character after another is very surprised that she's a cop.
Right.
I shouldn't have made fun, I guess. It's just a more basic premise than I was expecting based on the title. I feel a little misled because I was expecting, for some reason, you know, a team-up between a cop and a civilian woman of high social standing.
Perhaps an author of mysteries or something like that.
Maybe even a genuine blue blood, you know, a countess, a duchess, a baroness. Or maybe she's a widow, then she could be a dowager lady.
Right. But no, she's a lady.
Because I'm a dummy, I was misled by the episode itself, which actually starts with a scene revolving around a lady who is a criminal. And I thought, oh, so it's about the sergeant and this criminal lady, and they're going to have, like, kind of Hannibal Lecter, Clarice Starling sort of thing going on, where she's going to be his prisoner but give him tips and stuff, and that's going to be the show this is. But no, I'm an idiot. It was actually about his partner, the lady cop.
Why don't you introduce us to the plot for this?
Indeed. Well, the one and only episode of The Sergeant and the Lady begins with a woman, as I said, who's played by Barbara Whiting, on a crime spree. She seduces men, robs them at gunpoint, pistol whips them, and flees. When the woman is arrested, she refuses to provide any details on her true identity, her motivation, or the identity of her mysterious accomplice who has been helping her. So Police Sergeant Hastings, played by Jack Lord, and his partner, Policewoman Parks, played by Peggy Castle, aka the Sergeant and the Lady, must use the assorted scraps of evidence they've gathered to uncover the truth.
I can see why you thought the lady might refer to the Barbara Whiting character, because her character is sure given quite a setup, both at the pre-credits opening and then immediately after them.
She plays a very prominent role in the first half of the episode especially. And I have to say, her plan here, pretty high-risk thing for her to...
Robbing Marines... Don't rob Marines, pro tip.
And then pistol whipping them and trusting that she's going to have enough time to get away before they, you know. Of course, she has an accomplice who's helping her with that.
It's really neat how this episode almost opens like a silent film. You know, we imagine the dialogue between the character and her victims, maybe, but it's not necessary to actually feature it because the music and the images carry it a lot. So that's something I actually really appreciated about the opening of this show. It sets it up economically.
Then we go to credits and we hear the swinging main title.
But there's a little bit of a jazz swing to it before the credits, too.
Oh, yeah. No, the jazz swing is there from the start because she's just kind of swaying her hips at us as she's walking down the street about to mug somebody.
Yeah, there's a jazzy element present more often than not in this score.
Which for me is great. I actually really enjoy this.
It's the most striking thing about this score, and it's very different from, say, you know, we've had a little Goldsmith jazz on the show already in City of Fear.
And Perry Mason, the second score.
This is the first one I think you could describe as a full-blown jazz score.
Exactly. That is what I'm getting at. In City of Fear, it was this off-kilter beatnik kind of jazz. This, however, is full-throated, classically melodic jazz.
Mm-hmm. It's like cool. It's like we've got cool Jack Lord. It's important to note that this actually predates Perry Mason and possibly City of Fear as well, because this came out in 1958.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One of these earliest examples of this style.
Specifically to underscore cops, yeah, this is probably one of the earliest examples.
Just can't go wrong with Goldsmith in this genre. Any cop or detective show, you just know he's going to do something cool and snappy.
I love the off-kilter rhythmic quality to it. It's strident, but it's got a kink in its step a little bit, and it's really neat.
And kind of an instant earworm, too. I mean, this theme stuck with me a long time after listening to this score.
There's even a little bit of sultry jazz sneaking in there as well when Policewoman Parks, the lady, comes into frame as if to say, sure, she's a cop, but she's also a sexy cop.
Dun dun dun.
It felt very 50s feminine in the sound, but it's also a development or a rendition of the theme. It's just a different instrumentation and approach than Jack Lord's character gets. I'm really glad that this apparently survives in the vaults and was tracked in other things because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a cool, fun score, just kind of consistently enjoyable to listen to from start to finish.
Why can't there be a Dick Powell Presents where we get a nice 2.5 minutes of the Sergeant and the Lady main theme?
Because it never right, aired, it wasn't nobody released. Would have recognized it, but if it had,
What am I even saying this? I'm out of my mind.
We will get an extended treatment for the end credits, but extended being 40 seconds. It's just for this score, it feels so much more extended and developed than most of the other statements, because most of them are so fragmentary and you know, 10 seconds long. It's such a good theme. It makes a good impression even in the short amount of time.
As with Peck's Bad Girl, just these little transition cues all over the place. I do think the transition cues in this are a little bit cooler and more effective, maybe, than the Peck's Bad Girl cues. But yes, very much the same sort of thing, just bridging scenes or going into commercial breaks and so on.
No doubt. We've got another cool bit of jazzy action. For the scene returning from the commercial break following Blue Jeans, the female robber character,
brazenly trying to mug a Marine and take his wallet. The Marine makes a grab for her gun, and they struggle. She's nearly bailed out by an accomplice who pulls up in the car, jumps out, and conks the Marine on the head with a baton. This gives her a brief opportunity to escape.
But she has to go back for that wallet.
Pretty weak move there. You can't go back for the wallet when you have that little time to spare, but she did it, and it cost her.
Mm-hmm.
A brief but exciting bit of fight music here.
Yeah, it's a little bit more dramatic, and I like these big blasts of sort of jazz action in this cue.
.22 caliber, huh?
We're now introduced to the titular Sergeant and Lady, Hastings and Parks, as they apply the classic good cop, bad cop approach to the mugger we just saw apprehended, trying to find out about who her accomplice is. But the mugger is wise to that old chestnut of an interrogation technique and isn't so easily cracked. So we don't find out her real name either, which is why the cops just start referring to her as Blue Jeans.
That's one of the moments I like in this episode, when she just sort of immediately calls them out on this whole good cop, bad cop routine. It's like, yeah, no, I'm not biting.
I imagine that routine must have been tired even in the late 50s.
And I have to say, since we're talking about the sergeant and the lady, this is a case where I found the lady as a character a good bit more interesting than the sergeant. Jack Lord's character here, very much a kind of stereotypically gruff, tough, no-nonsense police officer, but there's not, at least on the basis of this, you know, abandoned pilot episode, not a whole lot to him. Whereas she has a little bit more inner conflict, and her uncertainty about how to approach certain situations at certain times makes her a more interesting character right off the bat, I think.
I enjoyed the actress, Peggy Castle, who played her as well.
Yeah, so Blue Jeans isn't cooperating, but luckily there are a couple of strong leads. There is a stolen ID card, for one. But get this. On her keyring, Blue Jeans had a miniature license plate keychain. A custom one for a real car. The cops find the number to find out that the car is registered to a Leon Kohler. I already had the sense that these criminals weren't the smartest when they were trying to rob Marines earlier. But carrying that kind of identifier with you as a decorative vanity object just takes the cake.
Yeah. You couldn't have hoped for a more obvious clue.
Yeah, I think the main reason they did that was because this is a half-hour show and they need to solve this mystery quickly. So that's why they're bad criminals.
Yeah,
true.
You know, a series of visits to different places, put the pieces together and wrap it all up sort of story.
So as Hastings and Parks get ready to drive to check out Kohler's last known address, he lectures her about the fact that she can't empathize with these criminals as people, but has to look at them unemotionally, which he explains dames struggle with.
Right.
Hastings calling Parks a good policeman and her correcting him, woman, and don't you ever forget it. This kicks off a brief driving scene and offers Goldsmith an opportunity to give us some more fun jazz variants.
A bit more slow and laid back, quote of the main theme.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool. I like that low rumbling piano stuff underneath too, which is a Goldsmith trademark.
And then after that slower quote of the main theme, there's kind of a new secondary theme that's introduced while they're driving that I kind of wish was developed more. I think maybe it appears one more time in the score. And this is less than half a minute long, but it's like, I dig it.
I dig it, man. It's groovy.
This whole score is really groovy. It's a lovely preview into what's to come, even though it's only scratching the surface as far as how catchy Jerry is eventually going to get.
I would say that if this had gone to a series and aired, I would rate this as one of his catchier TV themes, even though it's so early.
It would be awesome to have a 70-minute album of cues from various Sergeant and the Lady scores in this vein. That would be a lot of fun. But at least we have this one, and just pure entertainment here.
I'd be even happy if it had aired and, like Yen said, the Dick Powell Presents or something, a similar extended treatment like the Black Saddle theme got. I mean, this score is even slighter than Peck's Bad Girl in terms of length. It's less than 6 minutes long total.
So the Kohler residence turns out to be a bit of a bust. He didn't actually live there, but paid a landlady to use it as an occasional shipping address. And the landlady didn't keep any records. We only get a vague description of Kohler out of her. Hastings and Parks thus decide to follow up on the stolen ID card clue instead. And we get another bit of scene transition music underscoring a boat ride across San Diego Bay. This is the piece that we opened a podcast with. It's the point where Goldsmith's jazz is becoming so swingy that it's almost danceable.
Just cool as heck here. It's nice to hear it without any dialogue or anything tossed on top of it. Just gets 30 seconds of breathing room.
Right, aside from the opening and closing of the episode, I think this is maybe where his music gets to shine the most.
Such a short cue, but it feels like a lot in the context of this episode.
And I think there's a little bit more extended development of that secondary traveling theme that was introduced in the immediately previous cue, interspersed with statements of the main theme, but it's cool that it gets developed even a little bit.
And we're not quite in Glenn Miller territory here, but it's hard not to at least shake your foot to this.
I don't know, should we play it again for people? It's so short and it's so good, we don't want people to have to rewind to the very beginning of the episode when it's a highlight of the score.
It'll give you a good excuse to listen to the episode again when you're done. Just put it on repeat and let the Goldsmith Odyssey take over your day.
As the cue reaches its swingiest point, we crossfade from the boat to our heroes back in their car, pulling up on the suburban home of Claire Madigan, the woman whose ID was stolen. Claire won't tell her story to Hastings, but when he steps away for a phone call, she confides in Parks, presumably because she doesn't realize that Parks is a policewoman. Turns out she didn't want to report the theft because she was of an old friend from before her marriage at the time and was afraid that her husband would think she was having an affair. So when Parks makes it clear that this statement will be on the record, Claire has an angry outburst, throwing a glass at her. That's when Goldsmith brings a dramatic stinger, after which the music turns introspective as Park wonders about whether there was some truth to Claire's words and whether she is indeed a heel.
Good thing that missed her. The district attorney will want a statement, Mrs. Madigan. His office will be in touch with you. Let's go.
Maybe I really am a heel.
What do you mean?
Oh, about Claire Madigan.
What about her?
I didn't have to tell you what she said.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, it's funny. Kept running through my mind. She has everything. Blue Jeans has nothing. No house keys. Not even a house to live in.
Unit 437. Unit 437. 1019.
This is the first thing that sounds like more, I guess, conventionally dramatic underscore as opposed to just a jazz score, but it works really well. And these scenes, the interrogation scenes with the various leads / suspects, are probably the best scenes in the episode overall. The new shades that the assorted characters bring to this are pretty interesting. You've got that crusty old landlady who's pretty funny, actually, refusing to give up much info until they really threaten her. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this lady with the secret to hide that she thinks she can confide in policewoman Parks, and that telling a lady who also happens to be a cop this confidential info is safe somehow, which is a foolish move, but she does it anyway.
I think she's surprised at the end because she's not dressed in a policewoman uniform.
She just thinks that she's a random woman who's hanging out with a cop.
Yeah, it seems like it.
And can thus be confided in.
Maybe she assumed that she was his secretary or something like that.
Even
she's
then.
She's not in a police uniform.
The fact that people don't realize she's a policewoman works in her favor.
Yes.
Right. And even if they do think she's a policewoman, it probably works to her advantage in terms of seeming like a less threatening...
She's a good cop and a good cop, bad cop duo.
She's the good cop. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And she really is truly, you know, more of a good cop than her partner in a lot of ways. The sergeant just doesn't have time for any foolishness and just badgers his way through all these conversations when he gets involved.
He's kind of a jerk. He's like, you can't think of them like people, you know.
Yeah. These people aren't people. They're criminals.
they're not even criminals necessarily. They're suspects or people they're interviewing, and
they're information sources.
I did want to comment one more thing I liked in this conversation scene between the two partners. When she's thinking about the class differences between the two women, the blue jeans who has nothing and this woman who has everything. That hints at the potential for a little more depth to it, like, you know, going towards Perry Mason a little bit more rather than, you know.
Oh, that's a high watermark you're setting there. You can't.
I mean, just heading towards it a little bit, it hints at potential as opposed to, you know, Peck's Bad Girl has nothing in it that goes beneath the surface concept. It's a brief moment of humanity that I appreciated in this.
I will admit something to you. If you ask me right now, which would you rather rewatch?
Oh, boy. Oh. I would totally rewatch Sergeant and the Lady multiple times before wanting to see Peck's Bad Girl again, personally.
I am right there with you, Ivar.
Thank you. Oh boy, Jens.
I just think that Patty McCormick is really good in that role. I just realized that you made a Bad Seed reference at the very beginning of our show and we never explained it.
I did, and you didn't take it up. When initially watching it, I got a little bit of a sinister vibe from the main character, and I wasn't sure why, because I didn't put it together that she is the Bad Seed from a few years before, and it's just, it ended up being so vanilla of a role, which is a stark contrast to the Bad Seed.
And to Peck's Bad Boy.
Right. Well, for all we know, this is the worst episode of Peck's Bad Girl there is, and we just happen to have this one to review, and maybe the other episodes or the pilot episode were a little more interesting.
Which is why we don't rate TV episodes. Ba-dum-tsh-tsh.
Which is why we should rate Twilight Zone, because it does not depend on previous ones.
I'm willing to entertain this.
Issue tabled.
Maybe the other 13 episodes of Peck's Bad Girl are criminally underrated television. As criminal as the criminals that we are pursuing in The Sergeant and the Lady.
Oh, nice, what an transition. Expert transition back.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
Thank you. So Hastings and Parks are recalled to the police station, where they learn that the Marine who was knocked out during the botched robbery has died from the head trauma that he suffered. So that ups the stakes quite a bit. Hastings sends Parks to talk to the lady mugger again, woman to woman, to make her understand the gravity of the situation, but again to no avail. So Parks makes it clear that the mugger will stand trial with or without her accomplice.
I like the line of dialogue here.
Yeah, she talks about how her accomplice will take care of her, and Parks responds,
saying a judge will do that. I mean, this is like a moment where the actress hints at a darker side of the character, maybe. There's some threat in that that I really appreciated, and the judgmental statement of the main theme that plays with a dramatic commercial break finish. Immediately after this, we have another brief cue, but this is an act-in, another cool active statement of the main theme as the partners approach a pawn shop that Blue Jeans went to.
It's all right.
When the pawnbroker sees the picture of the mugger, he recognizes her as a girl who lives in a nearby trailer, to whom he delivered a guitar once. And Hastings and Parks are super excited about this. They go to check it out right away, of course. And the next cue underscores them leaving the pawn shop, and then intercuts between shots of Hastings and Parks walking through the trailer park and various unrelated police vehicles going about their business answering police calls, hence the ups and downs in the music.
I think it's two different cues, one after another. The music starts out more subdued as they're leaving the pawn shop, but it transitions to this cool blast of the main theme. Then more suspenseful treatments. Jerry develops his main theme, interestingly, in this cue because he takes those first four notes of it and he plays them kind of low and ominously underneath as they approach their suspect.
Days later, she comes by without a trailer. What does that mean to you?
Trailer court?
Exactly. Let's get out on all stations.
And
So Hastings and Parks arriving at the trailer is a significant turning point in the investigation, and we're in the last 5 minutes of this pilot, so I think we should jump into our review and then conclude discussion of the plot in the spoiler section.
Just for all those people who can seek this out and get their own copy.
Well, this is a solid, if kind of standard issue, police procedural. I would have been curious to see whether it evolved into anything over the course of, you know, a season or two, if it had lasted. But it seems for a pilot, you know, pilots tend to be a little bit on the shakier side, and it seems like a perfectly competent pilot that knows what kind of show it wants to be and where it's going. I don't think this would have been a classic of the era necessarily, but I think it's a perfectly fine half-hour time killer and has a few nice scenes that I liked. Again, the standout moments for me were all of the assorted interrogation scenes with some of the different people who may lead them to the ultimate truth that we're about to get to. But yeah, I dug it. It's a nice little episode.
This show didn't do a lot for me, and I think it's just because the investigation didn't interest me because it is so basic.
I think you've just been getting spoiled with Perry Mason's. You've watched so much Perry Mason that seeing something a little more standard and typical is disappointing in comparison.
Well, I'm not expecting everything to be a crazy convoluted mystery box, but this is really just these criminals are not very competent, and they leave behind some very obvious clues, and we follow those very obvious clues, and eventually one of them pays off the end.
But at least it doesn't tell you, like, right off the bat, okay, this is what's going on. It's kind of a surprise when you get there, even though the clues are pretty obvious.
There is a little bit of a surprise in the final revelation of the episode, which is why we have a spoiler section, but I was not entertained by it. I was more entertained by Peck's Bad Girl, and Peck's
really?
Bad Girl is objectively worse. This is a much more high-quality program,
yeah.
But I enjoyed Peck's Bad Girl more as a thing that diverted me and held my attention.
Fair enough.
I really enjoyed this one. It was nothing remarkable, but I thought that the leads had some good chemistry, even if there wasn't a whole lot to Jack Lord's character. There were a few dated moments, perhaps, in terms of the treatment of the lady character, but I thought she was by far the highlight of the episode, aside from Jerry's music. And Jerry's music carried it all really excitingly well, even though there wasn't a lot of it. I would see more Peck's Bad Girl more out of curiosity rather than the desire to enjoy it. Whereas this, if there was another episode, I would actually find it a pleasant way to pass 22 minutes of my time.
Neither of these shows are things that I would actively track down in my free time if I were just looking for something to watch, but if you lock me in a room for a day and say we got a dozen episodes of Sergeant and the Lady or a dozen of Peck's Bad Girl, which do you want? Definitely Sergeant and the Lady for me.
Yeah, easily.
Nope.
Oh, wow. This is an interesting disagreement. I would even seek out more of the Sergeant and the Lady if it was scored by Jerry.
If it comes down to scores, it's no contest. I'll choose Sergeant and the Lady if it means hearing more Sergeant and the Lady music, because that score is fantastic, and I want more. That is my biggest complaint, is lack of quantity.
The score's biggest crime is that there's so little of it, and it has so few moments to develop the material.
But it's so good.
It is so good. It's really good.
Like a great drug, just a little hit goes a long way.
First taste is free.
What about the score ratings?
Yeah, we have to rate it.
I will rate the score an 8. I think that is what it deserves, despite the fact that it... Okay, so far we've made a point of not reducing a rating based on length. We're just looking at quality, regardless of length.
You're rating this an 8? That's higher than Black Patch. I mean, does development count for nothing?
Okay, Black Patch is the 35-minute score. If I had 35 minutes of this, it'd be way better than Black Patch.
I disagree. Black Patch has some real depth to it. This is still mostly surface level. It's just totally fun and enjoyable. But man, Black Patch, that sequence for the love scene is just so gorgeous. It's A-level Goldsmith. And as fun as this is, I totally disagree with you on that.
All right.
So where would your rating fall, Yavar? I'm curious.
I'm going to go with a 7 for it because it's totally engaging and fun, but it leaves me wanting more. It's not as satisfying as I want it to be. And that's entirely, you know, the circumstances of the episode, but it does affect it musically. And Peck's Bad Girl was affected by what he had to write it for. And so is this, unfortunately. It wasn't an hour-long show. He wasn't able to develop it even as much as he was the music for Perry Mason. And I think that if this raw material was allowed to be developed more, it would end up possibly a 9 on my scale. But in terms of what he's able to do with it in this limited time, I'm going to land at a 7.
Well, I'm pretty sympathetic to Jens's argument about just judging this for what it is, you know, in the amount of time he has to work with here. I also landed at a 7 out of 10, but I think it's the most purely entertaining score of all the Goldsmith scores we've covered so far. The only reason for me that I wouldn't go higher than that is because I don't think it's a score that really has a whole lot of complexity. I think it just finds a fun, cool sound and sort of plays with that throughout the episode, which is fine. You know, it's a blast to listen to. But I don't think it's the kind of brilliantly insightful scoring that Goldsmith does at his best. It doesn't need to be. But yeah, I liked it. I liked it.
You've convinced me. I've gone too high.
Yeah, I think so. So are you allowed to revise it?
If you guys will allow it, I'm going to go down a half a point.
Okay.
All right.
To a 7.5.
We peer pressured Jens into changing his rating.
Uh-huh.
This is a proud day.
Okay, so let's average those.
Our final rating for the Sergeant and the Lady's musical score is a 7.2.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
You're right, that is the correct rating.
And, you know, of course, this is all subjective, too. Like, there may be some people who don't enjoy the jazz style as much and would just love the more flowery material he offers in Peck's Bad Girl, perhaps. But, yeah, I think all of us found this one a good deal more enjoyable.
Yes, and I enjoy the score to Peck's Bad Girl, but I know you thought I overrated that one.
I think you have a hard time going lower than a 5.5 for any Goldsmith score, Jens.
For a Goldsmith score that is not actively failing me in some way.
Yeah.
People who think, oh, no Goldsmith score is ever going to get a bad rating from us are greatly mistaken.
I have a couple in mind right now. But you'll just have to listen to the next 300 episodes or whatever to find out which ones those are.
Yeah. So let's talk about the rest of this episode, you guys.
Indeed.
We'll continue with spoilers after the beam.
When Hastings and Parks arrive at the trailer, Leon Kohler is there. Also in immediate prominent view, Kohler's car and the license plate matching the number off the mugger's novelty keychain. I was fully expecting him to be Blue Jeans' father.
Uh-huh.
Clueless about her criminal life. But no, it turns out that he's her husband.
And apparently also at least acting clueless about her criminal life. He's giving off very innocent vibes.
Yeah, he seems like a sweet, clueless old man who's probably being taken advantage of in some way.
I will say that he fooled me with the performance.
It's funny that we were fooled by this, because the crux of this whole episode is that policewoman Parks is not fooled by it.
Mm-hmm.
She protects her partner from Kohler getting his gun.
Exactly.
And the cue here, you know, there's a nice short little burst of action material and then some kind of slinkier jazz material as they head off afterwards. Decent little cue.
Oh, I should have been faster. I expected something.
So did I, but not in here.
Logic. It had to be in here. His only chance was to get rid of us fast and get lost again. Probably recruit another Blue Jeans to do his stealing for him.
And that's logic, huh?
Sure. Isn't it?
Come on.
I was disappointed there wasn't more of an action scene here because the action music starts out so excitingly and it lasts about 6 seconds. And then the action cue is over and it's transitioned to the neat, slow, jazzy
Which has a bit of a triumphant feel, though.
Yeah, at the end... Mm-hmm.
There's a nice crescendo there at the end of the queue.
It's a nice bow on the arc that was set up for Hastings and Parks early on.
I mean, the end of this queue feels like it might be the final queue in an episode. You know, they've apprehended the criminal, but no, we actually have to have a final discussion between the characters, and there's two more little bits of music before the end credits. And the first one, while the police report's being filled out, has more of that laid-back kind of jazzy stuff, which is really neat and I wish was developed more in the score.
And with complete statements by Leon and Jesse Cola, the investigation of this case is now finished. Just a minute, I'm not through yet.
It's sort of in the same vein as that cue for the conversation between the sergeant and the lady midway through the episode.
Mm-hmm. That seems to be their character-building music.
Yeah.
Did either of you get a romantic vibe from that?
You know, only as much as in certain other shows where they just want a little bit of that chemistry going on, but...
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like they were setting up a will-they-or-won't-they kind of attraction? In the scene?
I think maybe so. You can hear it in the music. You don't really see it in the scene between the two characters, but the music is kind of nudging that idea forward, like, oh, it's a sergeant and a lady, you know, maybe something here. But, yeah.
Yeah. This is as far as it ever went for Parks and Hastings.
I was just going to say, we do have a final little exchange between them, calling back to the earlier correction that she's a woman, not a policeman.
Yes, he gives her credit for her contribution and again calls her a good policeman. And she says,
woman, and don't forget it.
But yeah, climactic stinger to wrap things up, and thus ends the episode.
Well, speaking of wrapping things up, we should give some contact information. If you enjoy our show, please show your support by rating and reviewing us on iTunes. If, on the other hand, you've got any kind of feedback for us, please don't be shy and email us at mail@goldsmithodyssey.com. Our next episode in the Odyssey is a special 1950s wrap-up, focused on fascinating odds and ends and a couple of big surprises. You won't want to miss it.
You can see where all this is going a mile away. Granted, you know, sitcoms hadn't been around as long then, but still, the formula at work here is pretty obvious early on.
It's no excuse. Sitcoms had been around for much shorter time for honeymooners, and they're still timeless. They're still timeless and good.
Honeymooners.
Or even, you know, I Love Lucy, which is...
The two greatest,
dated 50s show, but it does it in an entertaining, comedic way, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I Love Lucy is funny, importantly, whereas this is... I don't think there's anything
really funny,
except for unintentionally funny stuff in this, but...
These comparisons are ridiculous, because I Love Lucy is a high-energy slapstick show, and this is not trying to be that at all. This is not a good frame of comparison.
Yeah. Again... I think the best point of comparison is Leave It to Beaver.
I just haven't seen much Leave It to Beaver, so you'd be better informed.
Okay, but I have, so I feel confident saying that's probably the iconic show of the era this is closest to, but Leave It to Beaver a little more sedate in tone, I think, than Peck's Bad Girl, but very similar with the whole kind of family conflicts that have to be resolved, and father and kids end up talking it out at the end, and everybody loves each other, and everybody goes home, get ready for next week's adventure.
But does it pull it off better? I mean, maybe less creatively, but...
To me, Leave It to Beaver is kind of a dull show, but it's less grating than Peck's Bad Girl is. So yes, I would say it did pull it off better, and obviously audiences of the era agreed, because everybody's heard of Leave It to Beaver, and no one has heard of Peck's Bad Girl.